What did you see in Africa that other people didn't?
What I saw was very young population, rapidly growing population, a mobile first population, a high degree of adoption of technology. I just thought with all of those things, there has to be a massive opportunity and I wanted to find it.
And what gave you the courage back then?
Marlon Nichols, as managing partner at Mac Venture Capital, he helps manage over $600 million in early stage capital, backing founders when they are still unknown and when conviction matters more than consensus.
Read all the books you want. You can talk to as many mentors that you want to talk to. But until you see businesses growing and failing and succeeding, you won't know what to look for. We're deploying 200, 300 million per year in Series A, Series B companies. So it's a lot of companies. You get those reps.
What would you say is the biggest misconceptions a lot of minority founders have about raising funds?
And can you explain that for our audience?
We see the tweets. And every single day, what we see is we love Afropolitan. This podcast is underrated. This is the best podcast ever. But the problem is 82% of you are not subscribers, but I know you guys are watching. So I need you to click the subscribe button so you can join the Afropolitan family. Thank you.
Marlon, so people who watch the Afropolitan podcast, they may be winding down from a long day. Maybe they're on their way to work. Maybe they're at the gym. So the first thing I want you to tell our audience is, what did you see in Africa that other people didn't?
Wow. I don't know that other people didn't necessarily see it. They may have just not had the courage to act on it. Right. And what I saw was a very young population, a rapidly growing population, a mobile first population. A high degree of adoption of technology. And so I just thought with all of those things, right, there has to be a massive opportunity and I wanted to find it.
And what gave you the courage back then? Because I still feel there's like a gap. Like obviously there are more and more people investing in Africa, but I feel like you've been doing it for quite some time. So what courage gave you to say, hey, I want to dive in or risk in it, even if maybe others still are not sure what I'm seeing?
It was a little bit by chance. So in 2015, I had a friend who had another friend that was an entrepreneur. And I was living in the Bay Area at the time, and he was building a company. And I was asked to go meet with him, just sit with him and, you know, learn about his business. And his name is Kenfield Griffith. I liked the business that he was building, and I really liked him. And so ultimately I decided to invest. But one of the stipulations was you have to join the board, and you have to, this company was in Nairobi, and you have to come to Nairobi at least once a year. And that was a blessing in disguise, right? Other than going to safari and stuff like that, right? Because I got to meet other entrepreneurs. I got to meet other investors. I got to meet ecosystem players, which made me more comfortable to invest in that environment, because now I knew who the players were. And I knew I wouldn't just be going it alone. And then fast forward to 2019, when we raised the first Mac Venture Capital fund, we had a Nigerian-based LP. And same thing, he was like, you have to come and experience it. So I came. I think that year I may have come, it wasn't in 2019 exactly, it was about 2020, 2021 when the pandemic was dying down. I think I might have come 3 or 4 times. And same thing, meet one entrepreneur, meet another entrepreneur, meet other investors, bank heads, et cetera, the head of Endeavor Global, like all of it, right? And so again, it felt like I wasn't in it alone, right? I knew who the players were. I had folks that would co-invest with me, show me where the hot deals were. You know, some of the founders of, the storied fintechs that came out of Nigeria, all of those things. So all of those people we're now connected with, and we're investing alongside them. So it doesn't feel, as risky.
Actually, I have a follow-up real quick. Where did you find this Nigerian LP? Like, how did y'all connect? Because I've never heard of a Nigerian LP most of the time. Most of the time, you just hear the VC or the investors.
It was random, actually. It's like my life is random, but it was random. There was a conference in Portugal, and I was speaking at the conference, and I was in the green room, and you know, it's busy, so I'm sitting there with my laptop just trying to work, and this guy comes and sits in front of me, and he just wants to talk, and I'm just trying to do my work, and I'm just like, I look up, answer the question, look back down. After a while, I was like, he's not going anywhere. So I close the laptop, start talking to him for a while. And then, he invited me to dinner. He had a group that was going to dinner. So I went to dinner with him. Turned out that I hung out with him for like 3 days straight.
Wow.
Then he flew to San Francisco area. So I met him in San Francisco with my other partners, and he decided he was gonna invest. So yeah, it was by chance, actually. I was not looking for any offshore investors. It just kind of happened. Yeah.
You're not looking for no Nigerian prince either. No, but Marla, you have a cultural thesis, right, when it comes to Mac Ventures. And I think the reason why I love it is it allows us to break down to our audience. We're very familiar with that thesis because that's also how we approach how we build here at Afropolitan. But what led you to that sort of thesis? And can you tell us a story when, you know, you guys were able to spot a trend 18 to maybe 24 months before Sand Hill Road could pick up on it, which is like Silicon Valley?
Mm-hmm. So it was a work in iteration. My first venture firm was called Cross Culture Ventures. And I was coming out of Intel Capital when I created that. And the last thing that I did at Intel Capital was to create a diversity fund, or help create it. It was a $125 million fund targeted at Black women and Pacific Islander founders. And learned a lot. The biggest takeaway for me was that, one, I do think Black culture drives popular culture. But the other thing I learned is that if you really want to give, call them diverse founders, underrepresented founders, underserved founders, a real opportunity, it has to be done under an umbrella that is a meritocratic umbrella, right? So if I stand up a fund and I say, I'm only going to invest in women, well, then all the critics will say, well, okay, you're investing in the best women led companies, not the best companies, right? And so I wanted to make sure that the firm that I created, we're going to invest in the best founders building the best companies in areas that we care about, right? So that's something that I learned from there. So initially the cultural investing was really thinking about what Black people are into and how it's going to shape the rest of the world. But then we took it a bit further and we said, no, culture is a bit more than that, right? The one thing that the through line between consumer products and business products is people, right? And the thing that people do is they act, they behave, right? And so if you think about what is popular culture, it's literally a group of behaviors that have become social norm. They've become popular, right? And so what we try to do is identify how are people behaving? Like, what are the trends that we're seeing to pick up in different parts of the world, and you know, come up with a thesis or a vision for it or a perspective. Do we think that this thing is going to have stay power? Is going to stick around for a while? And if it is, how do we think it's going to manifest itself down the road? And where should we start to invest so that we can capture that down the road? So one example of that, you brought it up earlier, Gimlet Media.
Yeah.
Right. We invested in Gimlet Media, I want to say like 2015. Right.
At what valuation?
I don't remember.
Yeah. What was the check size?
Yeah, check.
So this is out of Cross Culture. So it wasn't big. It was probably like $500,000.
Yeah.
Right. The first fund was like $15 million. So we couldn't write, you know, the size checks we write now. Now today we write up to like $4 million to begin a relationship. But then our max check was probably $1,750,000. So it was around that range. So, I mean, the outcome was like something like a 5X for us, right? But the dollar amount you know, wasn't a huge dollar amount because it was only like 500K, 750K investment. But at the time, you know, podcasts wasn't really a thing, right? And they were building what I called HBO of podcasting, right? Mm-hmm. So sure, they had, you know, conversational shows, but they also had like mysteries and like, you know, science fiction that presented like as if you're watching a movie, but you're listening to it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it took off and Spotify bought the company. And you can see where podcasting is today.
Everyone got a mic, bro.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but in terms of the mental models you use in analyzing deals, right? I think I got to see a preview of it a little bit this time last year, where the questions I would ask if I was in that position, you were already way ahead of it. I was like, God damn, this guy's great. this guy's good. And but I know that those mental models aren't necessarily something that folks are born with, right? It takes a while to iterate on it. What were some of the books, shows, movies, mentors who you relied on to develop your mental models as you approach these deals?
That's a really interesting question. Only because when I first got into venture, I mean, my managing director at Intel Capital told me it's going to take you like 7 years to actually get good at this. And I was like, crazy. I'm good at it now. What are you talking about? Over time, I understood what she meant. You have to get the reps. You have to see it, right? So you can read all the books you want. You can talk to as many mentors that you want to talk to. But until you see, you know, a bunch of different business models, until you see, you know, businesses growing and failing and succeeding, you won't know what to look for, right? It's just time. And the good thing about being in a place like Intel Capital, which at the time was probably the largest and most active venture firm in the world. I mean, we were deploying 200, 300 million per year in Series A, Series B companies. So it's a lot of companies. You get those reps. And you're also the people that you're working with. They've seen a bunch of things before you. And you get to talk through the deals with them. You know, what is it about? I think this deal is great. Like, why don't you like it? Oh, well, because, you know, when we saw company XYZ and they were presented with the same challenge, it was hard to overcome. And this is why it was hard to overcome. So I could never do a deal like that again. And, you know, you take that on board. It doesn't mean it's gospel, right? Because there's probably for every company that failed in that way, there's a company that probably succeeded. And so what is it about the company that succeeded versus the company that failed? And, you know, you take that in and you process it and you start to create your own lens. And then you go out and you start making your decisions based on the lens that you created. But it's based off of all this information that you've taken in over the years.
I actually wanted to go back to your investment in Gimlet Media, right? Because I think there's a lot of investors that are actually afraid to invest in media. And I feel like, you know, the VC space is a bit cyclical. Like there's a period of time like, don't invest in media. Now everyone is like, no, actually attention is currency. So now we're actually going back. So like, what is your current thesis on those type of media companies?
Media is tough right now. Yeah. Just because you're always looking at the exit opportunity, right? So every investment that we make, we're thinking, how do we get out of this investment, right? What does acquisition or IPO look like? Is it feasible? And so right now, there's not a lot of acquiring of media companies, or at least smaller media companies. The big media companies are buying each other, essentially, and consolidating, right? And so that makes it hard to invest in media right now. Though we've done it, you know, from a company named Riff, which was doing kind of you know, real-time product placement. You know, so you have an existing movie. And, you know, they can put products right in the scene, you know, after the movie has been cut and been sitting on Netflix or Prime or whatever for however long. Right. So it's a play on the advertising, which I still think has it's been slow to adopt. But I think ultimately what's going to happen is that these subscription video subscription platforms, they're going to hit the ceiling in terms of what people are willing to pay. Mm-hmm. And so then they're going to have to find alternative revenue streams. And I think it's going to have to go back to advertising.
Interesting.
And I mean, I'd be damned if I'm going to pay you $50 a month and sit through your ads, right? So instead of that, you know, can I place a bottle of whatever, you know, right next to us while we're having this conversation, or a box of cereal on the breakfast counter in, you know, in a breakfast scene, or a kitchen, you know, in a scene of a movie or a show. So so that was the thesis behind that one. We'll see if it plays out, because I mean, these customers have proven to be some pretty resilient, right? I think I just got a notification from Netflix. Yeah, we're raising your rate again.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh my God.
And they're able to do it, but I think they're going to hit a wall at some point. So we'll see. But then also, like, we did a company called Mansa, which Nate Parker, you might have known from Birth of a Nation.
Yeah.
So he and David Oyelo, they created this advertising video on demand platform, where now it's free, right? But you have to do the advertising. And so, you know, they're doing a bunch of stuff around short form, you know, media and things like that. So we'll see. So, you know, we've made some bets. We did a social media platform as well called Spill.
We know Spill.
And so, you know, so we'll see. But I think I've done enough for right now. and we'll see how it, you know, how it plays out.
Yeah.
But it would be hard for me to go into another media deal right now, just given the environment.
Yeah. What would you say is the biggest misconception? Because, you know, you're a VC, but you're also a Black VC. I'm pretty sure you get a ton of, you know, pitch decks, and folks have misconceptions about how the business of investing works. What would you say is the biggest misconceptions a lot of Black founders or diverse or minority founders have about raising funds that you typically sometimes take your time out to explain to them and to correct the misconception about the game that's being played right here?
Well, one huge misconception that always happens, whether it's a founder or an LP, is that, you know, because we're predominantly Black firm, Black facing firm, we got to be a diversity fund. I think I did I forgot why, but I did a ChatGPT search the other day. I was like, tell us who our competitors are and who our best co-investors should be. And it starts out with diversity, and we're like, well, we're not a diversity fund, so that's not correct. So that's one. But in terms of, you know, founders and them understanding what we do, oftentimes they don't get that this is a business, right? And like with every, if we're running a product company, let's say we were Apple, right? We're gonna make iPhones, right? We're in the business of making iPhones and iPads and whatever headsets, right? Like that's what we do. It's no different for a venture firm. We sell a certain business and a certain profile of underlying portfolio companies to our LPs. They're investing in us for that reason. And so, and they hate it. Like if I say we're going to be a consumer centric like VC, we're going to do all consumer, and then all of a sudden I'm doing all B2B and enterprise deals, like they're pissed, right? Because they have their own portfolio construction that they're setting up. And so I sold them on one thing and I'm doing something else. So oftentimes founders, like you, this is not a good fit for us. And they're like, well, why isn't it a good fit? Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, because we're going after these types of things and you're doing this type of thing. Or the stage that you're in is too early for us, mm-hmm. right? Like Mac is really focused on the seed stage, which is you've built a product, you're taking that product to market, or you've recently taken it to market. Like that's where we feel like we can be the most helpful. But if you're at a, you know, the idea stage, right, where you're still coming up with the idea, or you're pre-product, you haven't built the product yet, you don't even have an MVP of the product, it's probably going to be too early, right? There are always exceptions, but in most cases, it's probably going to be too early. Mm-hmm. And, you know, explaining that to them, you know, some people take it well, some people don't.
And get in their feelings.
What did it look like in the ZIRP era, but circa 2020, 2021, where a lot of the crypto stuff was booming? And I remember I was at Eat Denver that year, and, you know, there were LPs, there were investors in there, and they were just sharing stories about, you know, we used to be good with like an 8x or 10x return, and those would be the VCs of the year type of thing in the company. But now people are walking in with 84x returns from the tokens and the crypto stuff going, all of that. And it just feels like the crypto VCs within the funds that had separate sectors were the ones who were like, yo, these traditional VC guys don't know what they're doing, right? What did it look like inside of Mac Ventures when you're seeing and hearing these stories about, like, yo, these guys are doing like 84x returns, 100x returns? Not to say that Mac wasn't invested in Web3, but how did you guys maintain fund discipline and not like get caught up in that whole wave?
Have you followed up and see where those funds are now?
No, I know. They're all gone. They're all gone.
See, that's the thing, man. It goes back to what I was saying before, right? Portfolio construction, right? So, you know, we have a number of university endowments and pension funds and state treasuries and all that, foundations that are invested in us. And they're invested in our strategy. They don't want us to do that, right? Because they're, you know, venture is risky, but what you just described is even riskier, right? And so they invested in our strategy, not that. So we just stayed the course and did what, you know, what we said we were going to do. And that's what allowed us to raise three funds, you know, in basically 4 years.
And even what I want to know is, what are you personally excited about right now? And maybe your partner might have a different thing, but like as a company, what you guys are excited about to invest in right now?
Yeah, we have some core areas. So, and it, you know, we consider ourselves a generalist firm, but led by sector category experts, right? So the areas that I focus on are now energy, fintech, AI, healthcare. Those are my primary. My partner, Mike, he's all hard tech, aerospace and defense. And then my partner, Adrian, is a true generalist. It's all about, is this founder just an incredible human that I believe is going to create something exceptional? And so, yeah, so that's where we focus our time.
Etcher, remember that time I walked into a bank, I'm not going to give the name, and I asked them for $1,000, and they told me no, they cannot withdraw any dollar for me. And I was so upset, and I just remember asking everybody, how can I solve this issue? And I'm so happy that I finally have V-Band to finally solve this issue for me.
You know, the thing is, you should be able to have access to your money anywhere in the world when you get paid, right? So I'm grateful we have VBAN as a sponsor for the Afropolitan podcast. With VBAN, you're able to get paid in foreign currencies, whether it's pounds, USD, euros, and you can actually spend it in local currency as well. Now, you're also able to get a virtual card, which you can use to spend in and pay for services across the world, right? So I'm grateful to have VBAN as a sponsor.
You can download it on the Apple or Google Play Store. And remember, when you sign up, you use Afropolitan so they know you came from this podcast. And also, I want you to talk about, because you talked about some things that turn you off for founders, right? Can you name what does that look like? Because a lot of people that watch are raising capital, and I feel like a lot of times they're just not equipped with what is the right time to approach a VC like yourself, and even just what are the things that won't go well in a meeting or a pitch meeting with you?
I don't love the know-it-alls, right? Like you should have a very good grasp on, one, obviously the thing that you're making, but who are the competitors? What's going on in the space, et cetera. Like, you should know that way better than I should know it. But there are other things just about, you know, business building or whatever, right? That I may know a little more about it than you do. And, you know, the founders that are just arrogant and can't, you know, take a step back and listen and just take it on board. I don't have to be right, right? And maybe I'm not, but if I'm going to partner with you, I need to know that we can have those conversations, right? That you'll entertain, you know, my thought, right? Or this piece of information that I'm giving you, and make your decision, right? Mm-hmm. So you could think it's, you know, ultimately it's all bullshit, and you're not going to do it. Well, that's fine, right? But at least you listened, you heard, and you went back and you thought about it, you researched it, and you made a decision that you feel is best for your company. Because at the end of the day, you're the CEO. You're running the company, right? Like, my job is to advise you, to share, you know, the experiences that I've watched over the years. And then you take that and you make the decision that you feel is best.
And what are your thoughts on solo founders?
I don't mind solo founders, but, you know, if it is a solo founder, the one attribute that they must have in spades is they have to be an attractor. Right. And the reason for that is you can't name me one company that, you know, had a multi-billion-dollar outcome that was built by one person, run by one person. Right. Or built and run by, you know, subpar talent. You need exceptional talent to build these companies. And if you can't attract that talent, if you're not an attractor, then there's no way that you're going to be able to find success. So, you know, so I think there are other things that I look for in founders as well, or founding teams.
Yeah, can you explain what are other things you look for?
Sure. So you got to be an attractor. Someone on the team needs to know how to sell, right? Like, you can't have a product company and not be able to move the product. Someone's got to be able to sell, right? Then there's someone that has to understand the concept of product management, which is to say you can take a thought and turn it into a thing, right? That's a science and an art. And then there has to be someone technical, right? And I know that there was this saying, and you know, early in my career, I used to say it too. Well, if it's a tech-enabled company, you don't really need a technical person on the team. But what ends up happening is you outsource talent to build the thing, and most of the time you end up building the wrong thing. Mm. And so now you just spent, you know, $2 million building the wrong thing. And that took time, and it also resources. Took capital. And so now you're in the hole. We call it tech debt, right? And oftentimes that's what happens when there isn't someone on the team that understands the technology. They don't necessarily have to build it, but they've got to understand what's being built, and they've got to be able to guide whoever is building it to build the right thing. So those are the four things that are non-negotiable in teams.
It's funny because last night I was talking to one of my founder friends, and I was saying to her, I think I was on Clubhouse back then, and Naval was in the room, and he said, you know, startups are the Olympics of like technology business, right? Don't get into the ring if you don't believe you're out here trying to win gold, right? And I think sometimes a lot of founders, in my opinion, approach it from a scarcity mindset, which is like, I can be a solo founder, nothing necessarily wrong with that, but I will be the one who accomplishes it with subpar talent. And it's like that, there's no world in which that exists, right? So I think it's when you're then evaluating these teams, I just wanted you to, maybe if you concur with my statement, I said to them, like, investors, first of all, evaluate the team that they're seeing, right? And then, you know, the idea, the product, whatever it is that you have over there, and then they can then make a decision to invest from that. But how important really is their ability to attract talent?
It's essential.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's literally one of the four top things that we look for.
Yeah.
Because again, you cannot build an incredible, you can have an incredible team that's going after, you know, a decent market, and they have an okay product and still have a great outcome. Mm. You can have the biggest market in the world, a phenomenal product, and a crappy team, and it's going to fail every time.
Yeah, true, true, true. I'm even curious because this is the other conversation we were having last night on the side, was even co-founding teams, right? And I also said that besides attracting talent, that co-founding relationship is so essential and so important. So have you ever had to deal with like co-founders that were odds, or dealing with co-founders that wanted to, you know, split? Like, how do you manage those type of situations?
Yeah. So the way that you know that we've done our job in terms of evaluating, like properly evaluating the leader,
yeah,
is that they will handle that.
Mm.
right? So I'll give you an example. I won't name the company, but they were, it was a male and a woman co-founder team. And the woman one day decided that she didn't want to work with this man anymore. But she didn't talk to him about it. She called all of the investors and said, this is not going to work. And I need him out. And so to that, we were like, well, okay, what happened? So then she explained, they've been, you know, bumping heads for a while now. And said, well, have you talked to him? No. Well, you should talk to him. And, you know, actually, you need to talk to him within such and such time, because we're going to have to talk to him if you don't. So then she talked to him. The first thing that he did after he had the conversation was he emailed all of us with her own copy and said, we're having a challenge. Give us a week to resolve it. And he worked with her through that week. And then she left the company.
Oh, man.
And he resolved it. That company is doing amazing
right now.
Yeah.
He was decisive.
He not just decisive, but he was an adult. Yeah. Right? He was an adult. Like, he was like, no, you're not. If I leave it up to the investors, this might not go in the direction that I need it to go in. So I'm going to figure this out with her. We're going to come to a solution, and I'm going to bring that solution to you all and have you bless it. And that's what he did.
Amazing. And then I even want to talk about your team, right? Because your partners have different expertise. And so how did those different expertise, how did it come together? Like, how did you guys form your actual VC?
So, yeah, it's an interesting story. Because, you know, Mac is the coming together of two separate venture firms.
Oh,
so
interesting.
I had a firm, Cross Culture, that I co-founded with Troy Carter. And then ultimately Troy wanted to go back to music and build something there. And so he's like, take the brand and just keep building it, do what you want with it. And so I started, interviewing folks that I thought could become partners. Right. And then ultimately general partners, and I got close with a few of them. But while that was happening, my current partners, they were running a firm called M Ventures, also in LA. And had similar DNA. I also realized that we were doing a bit of co-investing together. And so I just said, look, guys, like, should we just try this out and see if this works? And so we spent 6 months working together and investing together, but out of our separate pools of capital, to see if we could coexist. It wasn't always smooth. it's still not always smooth. It gets rocky at times, because there's different personalities, big personalities. But it was the best thing that we could have done. I mean, I went from a $15 million fund to our first Mac fund, which is 110, right, to 250, right? And I think, you know, had I stayed on the path that I was going on, which is, let me just hire someone to come in that, you know, isn't necessarily as strong as I am, but, you know, we'll get there. We'd probably had two funds before we got to that 110, as opposed to, you know, these names, these people, these entities coming together and raising together.
And can you just talk about, because I also feel, and I especially felt like this the past few years, everyone wants to have a fund, right? Everybody's like, I have a fund, I'm raising a fund, I'm gonna become a partner. Can you talk about the real, like, number one, what it really takes to actually run a fund? What should qualify you to have a fund? What are the steps that someone should take before they even enter that arena? Because it's literally an arena they have to enter into.
Yeah. that one's loaded. You know, there were in the COVID era, a lot of funds, you know, did get stood up. Right. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that was that, you know, cash was free at the time.
Yeah.
Interest rates were super low. And so, you know, LPs were like, all right, we got all this capital. Let's just put it to work. And then you had all these, folks starting these firms. So they were like, okay, let's go. But then, you know, the what do you call it? The Ferris wheel stopped spinning. The interest rates started going back up. Yeah. You know, budgets started getting tighter. And then it came back to, are you actually good at this? Mm. Let's look at your portfolio. Have you made, you know, good investments? Are those things starting to pan out? Probably too early to see like true results, but what is the underlying, what is the performance of the underlying portfolio look like, right? Are these companies generating revenue? Are they growing? Are they spending more than they're making? Is there a path to profitability? Like all these questions, right? And then, you know, if the answers to those things are no, they're not re-upping. And so you had they call them graveyard, funds, right? Where they had a fund, they invested that fund, they can't raise the next one. And so they're just there, right? So a lot of that happened. In my opinion, I think there are a lot of things that go into successfully running a fund, right? Yeah. There's a difference between being a good investor and being good at operating a fund. Mm. Like the skill sets are very different, right? Being a good investor means that one, you have access to deal flow, high quality deal flow, a lot of it. You're a good picker. So of all those deals you're getting, you're able to select the right ones, right? And then you're able to win those deals, right? That makes you a good investor. And then obviously you can support the companies as they're growing. That makes you a good investor. To be a good fund manager, you've got to be able to do that. And you have to run a business, right? You have to make the hard decisions. Okay, we're going to invest in these sectors and not these sectors. We're going to hire, this many people and pay them. We're gonna grow the talent within the organization. We are going to, create a level of excellence around operating the firm. Like, these are all things that, you have to do and you have to do well, like selecting our, the fund attorney, right? Who's running our back office, reporting on a quarterly basis. Like what are we reporting? Is the information correct? How do we make sure it's always correct and no errors? Like this, all these things, right? Making sure that we don't do anything that's going to trip up our LPA, which is like the governing relationship between us and our investors.
Yeah.
There's just so much that goes into operating the fund. And, you know, once we got to a certain size, we hired a COO, and her name is Jennifer. And was like, okay, Jennifer, you do all of that. I don't want to do any of this anymore. I want to go do the thing that I think I'm pretty good at, which is the investing side. But it's hard. And I think a lot of the VCs in that era that you're mentioning didn't necessarily understand that. Right. If you're not going to be able to do that, if you're not going to be able to embrace those things, then you should probably just go work at a fund where you don't have to do all that stuff. You can just focus on investing.
Mm. That's really good advice.
What is it with the amnesia that comes with cycles, right? Where it's like, it feels like people go through these cycles, learn from the mistakes, and then a couple of years go by, the good times roll back around, and then they lose some of the discipline again. What do you think it is about like a capital at that scale? Because even during that whole ZIRP era, bro, like the things that you were seeing, the things people were even saying, but you go back a couple of years ago with maybe the internet .com bust, it's the same lessons. What do you think it is with us as humans where we're not able to just consistently learn from the mistakes of the past? And then we end up repeating them as we go. What have you observed in your opinion?
You know, there's some old people in venture, but for the most part, it's a young person's game. And, if you're at a younger firm, you haven't lived through those cycles. So it's not that you forgot. You just never saw it before, right? And some of the firms that have some folks that are longer in the tooth, they kind of try to avoid those mistakes. But I think you need those cycles actually, because if you think about these downturns, Google, Uber, a bunch of other companies, they come out of those downturns, right? Because what happens is like some real challenges are exposed as a result, and you get the companies that, you know, stand up and solve those challenges. So it could be painful in a moment, but coming out of it could be a really, really good thing.
I think being a founder sometimes comes with its ups and downs, right? There are times you go through burnout, co-founder challenges, just maybe you're not finding PMF as quickly, right? What do you see your role as a VC during the tough times? Because they always come, right? Do you see it as more as a therapist, as a coach, as a team member? What does it look like for you? Because I know you be up making, you know, the 1 a.m. calls, 2 a.m. calls. What does that look like for you? Or is it all of those roles in one?
It's all of those things. And it depends on who's on the other side of the table and what they need. There's one founder in our portfolio, and this particular founder, like, it's therapy. It's just like, remember, you are her, right? And that's the, you know, that's the conversation we have to have, because she's exceptionally talented, but sometimes forgets that, and the confidence, you know, wanes. Others, it's well, are you making the difficult decision, right? Like, I know cutting people is not easy, right? But if you don't do this now, and if you don't cut very deep now, what does that look like for the company in 6 months, right? And so it's just like being that voice of reason. You know, again, your decision, right? But if you don't do it, this is what is likely going to happen, and we're going to revisit this conversation at that point.
How important then is self-awareness in a founder for you when you're evaluating them?
Oh, huge. Huge. It goes back to that. I don't know if I said it today, but we might have talked about it yesterday. Humility, right? And it's the, you know, yeah, I know a lot, but I don't know everything. And I'm willing to take some things on board and learn and grow, right? Those are the best founders, because they're willing to listen to shifts that are happening in the market, the voice of their customers, right? Even their employees, like, you're listening, you're taking things on board, you're making decisions based on the information.
So Marlon, let's shift back a little bit. How did your background, as you know, moving from Jamaica, moving to the US, how do you feel like your family background helped shape who you are today?
I feel like everyone in Jamaica is an entrepreneur. Right?
You guys like Nigerians. Everyone's hustling.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I grew up with one, right? My mom was a cosmetologist who, you know, started doing hair in our kitchen. And then, first of all, she was a nanny so that she could put herself through cosmetology school. Then was doing hair in our kitchen, then rented a booth at someone else's salon and ultimately owned her salon, which, you know, paid for me to go to Catholic school and, you know, other things that I did growing up. And I just, you know, saw her take nothing and turn it into something that basically, you know, provided for our household. And so I've always, even before I realized that I admired it, I always admired it and wanted to be a part of that journey in some way. And, you know, my career has been in three parts so far, right? The first was I was an operator. I was like the 10th employee at a startup that we helped grow into the UK and Europe and sold. And so I was operating and building. And then the second stretch was as a consultant, right? And there I was advising. And I felt like I missed operating. So then I was like, I feel like there's something in between these like Goldilocks type thing, right? There's something in between these things that I would really enjoy. And it turned out to be venture. And that's because I do get to go along on that entrepreneurial journey with the founders, you know, as their partner, right? I do get to tap in from time to time to help them create strategy and, you know, and even think about operations and stuff like that. But I don't have to own it, right? This one thing. Because I also realize that the entrepreneur in me wants to have variety, like different challenges. And so in working with a number of startups at the same time, I get that variety. That's kind of how I got here. It's kind of, I get to operate some, I get to advise some, I get to go for the journey, like the ups and the downs, all of it. I enjoy it.
Do you feel like Capital Allocation has a worldview?
What does?
Worldview, like being able to allocate capital. Do you believe it has a worldview? Do you believe like capital should have a worldview? Or is it just strictly, I give you my money, I expect money in return? Do you believe that people who allocate money should have a worldview as to like what they're choosing to invest in, the sort of world that they hope to see from the investments that they make, like the impact as well?
Yeah, I mean, you have a thesis, right?
Yeah.
Every investment that you make, you have in your mind what, you know, what this outcome is going to be, whether it's financially, whether it's the impact that it's going to create, or whatever, or all of the above, right? And you're doing it for all of those reasons, right? So I mentioned energy as a key sector that I'm focusing on right now. And the reason, yeah, I think it's going to be lucrative, right? But I also think it's just necessary. Like we're about to bump up against some real constraints. And unless we can, you know, solve for that, we're going to have some real problems. And so I want to be a part of the solution. So that's why I'm putting a lot of time into energy.
Can you speak a little bit more to that? Because I know I'm aware of it. Like obviously with the data centers coming online, China generating like tera gigs worth of energy, right? And the U.S. seems like second to the game. What is your energy thesis? And for folks who are watching, like why is energy going to be much more important moving forward?
Yeah. So our grids, I think around the world were, you know, built to withstand a certain capacity, right? With AI, AI requires significant compute power, significantly more than we've ever seen. And so if you're going to pull more compute power, you're actually going to pull more power as well. And now we're going to we're in Nigeria. Like how many times a day does, you know, does the grid fail?
Yeah.
Right. And your power, your, gas Marlon, generators Marlon, have
why
to
you
come
exposing
on. And,
this like this, right? Man, it's a global podcast, bro.
Listen, I'm just saying, like we're here. So
right,
I'm talking
you're
about
right,
it.
You're
right.
Right. You're right.
But the same thing happens in Dallas.
Yeah. It's facts.
Right.
It's facts.
Maybe not every day, but it happens. Right. We're just going to hit against this wall and we need to resolve it. And I think the way to code for it, if you will, is going to be alternative energy sources, right? It's going to be nuclear. It's going to be solar. It's going to be batteries, right? And software has got to play, and AI are going to play a huge role in determining, you know, how much power is, you know, is being generated from this part of the equation and this part of the equation. When do we distribute it, you know, from this part or that part? You know, how do we maximize intake? How do we maximize output? Like all those things. But if we sit around and wait for governments to rebuild the grid, like it's not going to happen. So
true.
Well, let me ask you this. When the crypto thing was going on, right? I know, like you said, you guys were able to maintain fund discipline because, you know, you already have your thesis, your mm-hmm. strategy. When you compared that, though, to when AI came to the party, right? Like when ChatGPT maybe got released, what did it feel like within the firm to be like, no, this is like a meteor hitting the planet and we have to adjust to this versus saying, well, this is just another technology shift. Maybe we have a plan to invest in it at some point. But was there a remarkable difference from the crypto era versus the AI era? Like what can you speak to that?
Well, one has massive implications on basically everything, The other is a currency, right? So, and in a volatile currency at that, right? And so it wasn't a hard decision for us. Also, written into our LPA is like, we can't invest in currencies anyway as a part of that fund. So it wasn't a thing. We did look at, some of the blockchain technology, that supports, these currencies. And we've made blockchain in investments, but not in the currencies. Mm-hmm. It's just too, it feels like gambling to me.
So what's the AI thesis then, like for the firm? Like when you think through it, and it, not just for the firm, but in general for you, when you looked at AI, you're like, okay, if this is going to represent a remarkable shift, how should we approach it from a fund allocation perspective?
So what is unique about, this play, I guess, is what is how we look at it. So if it's not a foundational model, right?
And can you explain that for our audience, what that
means? So that's like OpenAI and Anthropic, like the big multi-hundred-billion-dollar companies right now that most other AI companies are pulling from, from their models. They're leveraging their models to do whatever they're doing, right? There can only be so many of those, right? And I think they've been created already, right? But there are smaller foundational models, like specific to, say,
legal, maybe?
Battery consumption, right? Since we're talking about energy, right? So what is it about the way that model calculates energy usage that's going to be well beyond what OpenAI and Anthropic and all the other ones are doing, right? So that's one way that we look at it. Like, is there something unique about this model that will win? And it's probably in a niche space. Doesn't that, like, energy is massive, right? So I say niche is just your focus. Mm-hmm. So that's one. The other one is, okay, if you're going to be leveraging those existing foundational models, is there a data set that you have that's unique to you? Like, do you have proprietary data, right? Because you're always looking for what's the differentiator, and is it sustainable, right? And so if you have unique data, then okay, that makes you different than everyone else. Yeah, everyone is using that same model, but your data is better, right? Your data is more robust or whatever, right? And then the third element is, is there something that allows you to, let's say you're using that foundational model, you're using data that's available to everyone else. Is there something in your logic that allows you to get to better answers faster? Right. So that's how we look at AI from a technology standpoint. From a business standpoint, if it has to be a good business to begin with. Right. Like, AI is not going to turn, just because you add AI to it doesn't mean it's going to be a great business. Right. Yeah. So we have to start from the standpoint of, this is going to be an exceptional business. Right. Or can be an exceptional business. And by applying AI to it, we're supercharging it. Right. We're allowing it to scale a lot faster. We're making sure that things cost less. You're producing more, et cetera. So yeah, that's kind of how we think about it, or at least I think about it.
But when you speak to, the proprietary data or the data sets you're bringing, how really is long of a moat is that, especially if they're using like an OpenAI underneath it, right? I know OpenAI obviously claims like, hey, we have like a Chinese wall or whatever, but we've also seen them go ahead and launch like products that compete with existing rappers on their platform. So realistically, how much of a unique set is that, and for how long before the model itself just swallows all of it and says, okay, we got this now?
I just committed to investing in a battery optimization company that's all software, leveraging AI. Yes, I think they're using pieces of those big models, but the differentiator here is the data that they get, because they're working with all these energy providers, and each of these providers have their own data sets, right? And this is not a moment in time. You don't just collect the data today and use that same data going through. You're collecting data every day from these individual sources and you're bringing it together. So unless OpenAI gets access to that proprietary data, they're never going to be able to compete with this company in this way.
Okay, that's interesting. I also want to hear, if do you have any thoughts around the creator economy? Is there any interest in it? Have you guys looked at it? Because I know there's a lot of attention in that sector as well.
Yeah, so I mentioned Mansa, I mentioned Spill. Those are both, they're media, but they're also creator economy type companies. They're, another area where I'm not focused on and anymore. I think we need to see some results before I can kind of go back there. But in theory, it makes sense, right? You have all of these creators that are popping up, and they need tools to run their businesses so that they can create, right? But I mean, how many of these tools need to exist, right? So how good is good enough? Right. And so I just don't know. I haven't seen anything that, gets me like super excited about, that I want to invest in the creator economy. Spill was interesting because, it's a social network, made from Black and queer folks, which are typically the underlying creators of everything that's fun and interesting on the internet. But the problem is that in most of the social networks, those people never get the credit. They never get to participate in the, in the cash component of it. Because what happens is someone more popular will see it, they'll adapt it, and then they'll start, monetizing it, right? And so what was interesting to me about Spill is that they allowed you to do what you do. And yeah, other people are going to iterate, right? They're going to be derivatives, but you'll still get paid. When they get paid, you get paid too, because you're the source code, so to speak. So that was interesting. So we'll see how they're growing their audience. They're doing pretty well. We'll see how it turns out.
So Stephen Bartlett had this thesis, and I wanted to get your thoughts on it. And he was saying, in this age of AI, it's going to drop the cost of creation down to zero for a lot of things, or at least just down significantly, right? So whether it's code, whether it's content, and that he believes that the next moat, is going to be distribution. It's always been distribution, but that distribution through trust-based audiences. So if you're a creator like a Mr. Beast or, maybe at Show Speed, your ability to retain attention is going to be very important in an AI-dominated age, right? So I wanted to get your thoughts on that. What do you think about that?
I mean, yes and, right? I don't think it's all distribution in the way that you say. I think certain platforms will be built like that and they'll work. It's the question of super personalization versus virality, right? And can the two things actually live together? I don't know. I think we'll have to see. I literally had an argument with someone at Meta about this a few weeks ago. I'm like, look, if you're saying that the business model is changing to being super personalized, then say that. But the current business model is not about being super personalized, right? Because the things that I like are different than the things that you like. And if we go very deep into the things that I like, well, you're now producing for an audience of one.
Yeah.
Right. Versus you have this, this thing that everyone is attracted to, so the pushback was, well, yeah, but it's not going to be that personalized. Right. Like there are millions of other people that see things just the way that I do.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see.
Wait. So sorry. Just so we're clear. What do you specifically mean by super personalization?
It means I'm seeing something that is literally interesting in all levels to me. It knows what I like. And so it's going to produce this thing that it knows that I like. And that's fine. But that's not how social media works today, right? It produces a thing that a lot of people are going to like, and they're going to interact with it or whatever. But now, if it goes in the way that that I think they're describing, yeah, it's going to be tailored to me, but then I can't send it to Chica because she doesn't care. Like it's that's not, she's not into that.
You never know.
Maybe, right? But if you make it super personalized, yeah, then I don't know.
Yeah, it's like one of one. It's like only a channel of myself and just looking at different content I have because it doesn't relate to the other people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think, and I want to clarify what he said. So, because I understand the angle of what the AI will play with it. He was more saying, because I think there's another Naval quote, you know, I'm always dropping Naval quotes on you, but he basically said the currency of time is not money or time, it's attention, right? So I guess the thesis would be in the industrial age, the currency was money. In the productivity age, the currency was time, be more productive. In the digital era, it's attention. So the ability of any creator to hold attention for a long time, not virality, because virality can just be in seconds, but your ability to actually retain attention allows you to then be, to have your products just be strictly distribution. You no longer have to say, I actually have to go build a product to sell. Your product in of itself is the distribution you're able to gain from the attention you're able to capture.
I'm not disagreeing with that.
Yeah.
I'm just saying it's a different business model.
Yeah, no, definitely. Right? Of course.
And so if it's a different business model and we think that that's the way forward, then great.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, say that.
So actually, I want to switch gears to Culture House, right? Because it has become this phenomenon and it scales across different parts. And I want to understand when you created it, what was in your mind and what is it now?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have a co-founder in Culture House, Rodney Williams, who's a kind of a serial entrepreneur at this point. And this was shortly after I made my first investment in his first company. And we were at South by Southwest and we were going to all the different gatherings and parties and all that stuff. And the room was just void of brown faces. And, you know, and the music didn't feel fun. The food was bland. And, you know, we're just like, look, what if we tried to create a space that felt more comfortable for folks like us? And so we stood up this brunch and people really enjoyed it. And the majority of the folks in the room were black and brown. But everyone that you needed to meet, wanted to meet, was in the room. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so there were white people there too. There are investors there also. There are entrepreneurs. There are corporate executives, government officials. Like, they're in the room. And then we got feedback afterwards saying, make it longer. So then we added a day party to it. So now we had this brunch. Then we had the day party. They're like, make it longer again. And so now it went into the night. So three components, the brunch, the day party and the nightcap, and people could come and go and, you know, whichever piece they wanted to. There were panels in the first two sessions. The nighttime session it's a party essentially. There's networking throughout the day. There's good food. You know, the music that's always on is music that we like, right? A heavy bass. It's like stuff like that. Right. So, it just, you know, people really enjoyed it and we enjoy bringing people together. And so, you know, I just started expanding to other locations out of South by Southwest to then include Martha's Vineyard and Afrotech and Art Basel. We did an activation in Cannes this past year, but that was just the party. It wasn't the full like activation. So it's just, you know, playing around with concepts that bring really smart people together and help them to have fun and be productive.
And have you seen or actually have scouted actual investments in these specific culture houses?
Yeah. And we had a company in the cross-culture portfolio called Playversus. And we invited the entrepreneurs, a guy named Delaine Parnell, and an investor, Peter Pham, and introduced the two of them. And, you know, Darnell had an idea, and science, Peter's firm, they incubate ideas. And coming out of that, they built a company that raised a lot of money. And we were fortunate to, you know, have an opportunity to participate in the round. But yeah, stuff like that happens all the time.
At Cultural House, yeah. I love it.
What does the principle of skin in the game mean to you, right? I think you talked about, you know, you're in consulting, you're seeing, you're watching from the sidelines, but you were an operator before and you had that itch, right, to get back into. What does skin in the game look like for you, especially from an investor? I think we had a conversation last night where, you know, you said, you know, we're investing in this company, or you were pitching a company to some other investments firm and they're like, well, are you going to invest? And you're like, yeah, for sure. What does that principle mean to you, and when did it become something you even started to live your life by? Like, if I'm going to go into something, I have to have skin in the game with it, or I'm just not doing it.
Yeah, it was coming out of consulting, right? Which was like, you know, there was operating and then there was consulting. And consulting, what I liked about consulting is that I was always interacting with executives, right? And we were talking strategy, we were talking operations. That's fun. What I didn't like is that I wasn't there to see the project through, right? So we would come up with an idea that, you know, obviously we thought was a great idea. And who knows if they implemented it in the way that we wanted them to implement it. Who knows if it worked, right? But then you're on to the next thing, probably pitching the same concept, same idea, without knowing the true results, you know, of the last thing. Yeah. And that didn't feel good to me. I wanted to, you know, to see if these things would play out in the way that, like, we envisioned. And so, you know, being there in the good times and the bad times, the tough times, I think is about having skin in the game. And as an investor, you're invested.
Like, literally.
If I decide to stop paying attention, the money is still there. Right. So, yeah. So you are invested.
I want to talk about why aunties are so important to African history. Aunties represent curators of the African experience, and oftentimes they have been unacknowledged. They have literally held our archives before they were archives. They were literally institutions before we had institutions. They held so many important cultural artifacts, such as the way we braid our hair, the recipes of our cookings. They represent abundance. There's literally a reason why we call an African culture rich aunties. And we believe that with partnering with Anthony, we're able to showcase this type of history through art. So to connect to African history and get a piece of the Anthony and Afropolitan collection called Auntie, make sure to click the link in the description. And this is your way you can support our channel.
All right, we're about to switch to our rapid fire segment. This is where you give the first thought that comes into your head.
Dangerous.
Yeah, no, not too dangerous. Don't worry. Gimlet to Spotify or Pipes 150x paper game, which felt better and why?
Pipe feels better today.
Okay.
And because of the potential, the outcome that we'll likely see from that is amazing. And then also the reach. There's so many small businesses in this world that are struggling with working capital needs. And to be able to execute on a working capital loan without by eliminating basically all the risk associated with it is huge. It's just you're gonna be able to touch so many lives and make so much fucking money.
Mm. One piece of advice you'd give 2015 Marlon that would have saved you the most pain.
Man. Really vet the people that you decide to work with. Make sure your why is aligned and your what is aligned.
How important is integrity for those sort of partnerships, by the way?
Huge. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I mentioned our LPA, which is our government document, right? Like, I've got to trust that my partners don't do something stupid, and they got to trust that I don't do something stupid that's going to trip that up. Because if you trip that up, everything stops. Like, immediately, the investors, you're no longer investing anything until we get to the bottom of this and we come to a solution that we feel good about and that you can accept. So your paychecks stop, everything stops, yeah. right? And so you have to, there's a level of trust there, you know, that you're doing the right thing.
What's the biggest red flag you tend to see in pitch decks?
In pitch decks?
Yeah.
You know how they have the, what do you call it? It's like the 4x4
yeah,
quadrant.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're like, we're here.
And everybody else is somewhere else, right? Come on, man. Like that's not gonna be true. Right. So and you know, that goes back to like really understanding the market and the competitive landscape and where you fit in that. And being like true about it, right? Because if I've been in meetings where, you know, entrepreneurs like, yeah, we're the only one doing this. And, you know, as they're talking, we're, you know,
Googling,
we're ChatGPT and now doing all the things. We're like, well, have you heard of such and such? And if the answer is no, then it's like, well, you don't know the market. you don't know who your competitors are. And if you're not paranoid, then you're not the person for us to work with.
I mean, I guess there's a good type of delusional to being a founder. Like most founders have to be delusional to maybe proceed to go do something that's impossible, but delusional enough to not know or be aware of your
competitors. You have to be intellectually honest.
Yeah. Mm. That's what we're talking about. Yeah. What is the most underrated trait in a successful venture capitalist that nobody talks about?
People management.
I like that. Wait, I have a question that I need to know. What's your favorite Jamaican food?
So many. This
So many.
You know, I'll always do an ackee and saltfish for sure. Mm. There's so many. I mean, there's so many. I will go with ackee and saltfish.
Okay. And what's your favorite city in the world?
Actually, no, let's go with goat head soup.
Oh, goat head soup. Ooh. Yeah. Okay, I like that.
Yeah.
No, oxtails, bro.
You can get oxtail anywhere. Like, it's just to get a good goat head soup, you probably have to be in Jamaica.
Okay.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Have you found one in the US?
No.
Really?
No.
Unless someone at their home is cooking it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But even then, it's hit or miss.
Okay.
What about favorite Nigerian food, you know, when you're out here?
Pepper shrimp.
Pepper shrimp.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I like that. Okay. You like spicy food.
Yeah.
I mean, and what is your favorite city in the world?
Right now it's LA.
Mm.
Yeah. Because it's where I live and I can't imagine living anywhere else. At one point it was London.
Really?
Because I lived there in building that company for like 2.5 years. And it was fun. It was a lot of fun. A true international city.
Mm. Was it weird like choosing to base the firm in LA while some people maybe choose New York or SF? Yeah.
It's a very intentional decision. So when Troy and I were building Cross Culture, I was living in the Bay Area. He was living in L.A. And there are so many venture firms in the Bay Area. And so what we said was like, look, we can be one of a sea of others. Or there's this growing ecosystem in L.A. And if we do this right, we can really just stand out. So part of it was a lifestyle decision. Like, it's so much more pleasant to live in LA than the Bay Area, especially as a black man. But the other part was a branding and firm building decision. Yeah. And we just thought that from a marketing perspective, we could do so much more branding LA.
And also, you know, the funny thing about that decision is when people think, or at least in my circles, when people think about VC firms in LA, Mac Ventures comes up, and it's not the black VC. It's like VC in general.
Great. Right?
So that was an intentional decision.
Tell that to ChatGPT.
ChatGPT, man.
Sam, get it together, man.
And the last question we ask every single guest on this podcast is, who do you want to see on this podcast and whose story do you think needs to be told?
Oh, I should have asked this ahead of time about this.
It could be anybody, too.
You know what? I would love for you guys to have, this is shameless, but I don't care. The founding team from Shekel Mobility.
Okay. Yeah. We met them last night.
Yeah, yeah, I liked them. I remember saying, they're interesting. I remember noting that in my mind.
Yep.
Okay.
They are building a phenomenal business. It's a global business, started here in Nigeria. They're profitable already.
Can you talk about what the business does for our viewers?
It's basically having an auto dealership in your pocket, essentially. They started out by lending to, secondhand car dealerships, right? You guys know this, but the demand for cars in Nigeria, in Africa, is huge.
Yeah.
And they're always secondhand cars. Yeah. Like, no one buys brand new cars for the most part. But supply is limited. And the reason why supply is limited is because the dealers can't afford to buy the car. So similar to pipe, there's a working capital issue. So they got line of credit from the bank, and they were providing the capital to these dealerships and collateralizing the lending with the vehicles. And then they were like, you know what? What if we allow these dealerships to trade and buy from each other, right? Because you might be in one part of the country and you want, I don't know, car A, right? But it's not there. But your dealership has it. Right?
Wait, so, you telling me that wasn't built already?
No. Because these are small businesses, right? And so now you have a platform that allows you to do that. And also now you can source cars from other countries and bring it into your dealership. And in other countries, now they have other parts of the platform. So you want to go to an auction, but you're small. You don't have you need a certain, your balance sheet needs to be at a certain level in order for you to participate in the auction. So now you can use their license, go to the auction. Okay, so then you need the car repaired. All right, well, now you got to go to a shekel authorized place to do it. You need a place to store the cars. Okay, well, we have shekel authorized storage places. So it's like everything that you would need to run your dealership right on your phone in your pocket.
Vertically integrated, basically.
Yep. Mm. Yep.
I want to give you a position to pitch another company, Carrot Credit.
Yeah.
We'll lose a friend.
Yeah.
I want you to walk through what your thesis was for that. Yeah, definitely. What was your thesis for investing in Carrot?
Yeah. It was kind of, you talked about crypto. But in addition to crypto, the Robin Hoods of the world and Bamboos of the world exist now. And more Africans are participating in public markets and in crypto. And but they can't do anything with it. And so what Carrot is doing is allowing them to actually leverage the equity that they own and use it in the form of revolving credit. So imagine having a credit card, essentially, where you're borrowing from yourself almost, right? And paying a small interest rate on the funds that you borrow. And I think, we talked about super young population, average age 18, mobile first, also now, really diving into crypto and those other kind of alternative currencies and equity, public equity. Like, there's just a huge opportunity that's coming, and they're kind of ahead of the curve. And you mirror that you add that to the fact that revolving credit is something that doesn't really exist here.
Yeah.
Right. So you can get some from like the mobile carriers, for instance, but they're small numbers. The other ones, they're going to require like physical collateral, right? Like, either you have a lot of money in the bank, in which case, why are you not using that? Or you have a home that you can, put up as collateral or something else. And a lot of people don't have that, right? So it's they're modernizing revolving credit, right? And using this new phenomenon of like cryptocurrency and or alternative currency and trading in public equities.
Marlon, thank you for stopping by, bro.
Thank you so much, Marlon. This is great. Amazing.